direct their questions or their anger, I suggest that you come to me or somebody on the commission and not towards our staff.
Please. Yeah, I didn't mention staff. Thank you.
I'm just letting you guys know.
Yeah.
All right, any additional discussion? Any additional public comment on this item that did not fill out a blue slip but would like to make comment? Mr. Phelps. Sort of, kind of. You seem uncommitted.
Combined both on my blue slip. I apologize.
Oh, did you? I apologize. I do have your blue slip as well as yours, Steve.
And it's hard to read. I'd like to speak as an archer and an archer who hunts in limited archery units that are not limited during the rifle seasons, quote the Gunnison Basin. There was a lot of, when the Gunnison Basin limited archery, we went through a lot of the same talking, same concern. I want to sit here debating 10 years later, how many years later, it is a much better archery hunt for brass, okay, locally having limited archery. What it kind of eliminates, when you get these archers down to one specific GMU, it eliminates the cherry picking that went on prior to that. Prior to that, I would hunt one little section of 54 that was great, a section of 55, my favorite, a section of 551, another one of my favorites. Now when I apply, I got to pick a unit and stay there. By doing that, it has helped with the elk distribution in the Gunnison Valley as far as moving them into hell holes where they don't get harvested or onto private land. I do think that, ma'am, I got to plagiarize your seepage comment. You know, Front Range people seeping to the west slope. I love that. We're seeing our big game herds more and more inundated by everyday intrusion into their territory. I think that rather than going statewide limited, which I've always been a big fan of, I think tool in the toolbox, we're going to be looking with a lot of over-the-counter with caps for second and third rifle hunt. I'm just here to say that bow hunters can be very hard to please. I would like to thank this commission as a bow hunter. The September 2nd to September 30 archery season is an absolute governor's tag for me personally. Thank you for the new five-year season structure. And limiting archery elk license in Gunnison has helped the elk and the elk hunting in the Gunnison Basin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phelps. Commissioner Haskett.
Thank you. I actually have a question for you. So I thank you for coming. And I understand that 54 and 55 were changed in 2010 because of the request of the locals there. And you hunt there now. When I look at it, just I wanted people to know that it's not the end of the world. You can still hunt. You can draw with 0 points at 97 and 99% results. I think that's great. So to the ones who have concern, you can still hunt. And I don't think that just because it goes draw, it means that you can't. And you're an example for that.
You can still hunt. You can accumulate preference points. Right. You know, but if you're, you know, like a unit, first choice, you get to hunt. Mm-hmm. September 2nd to September 30th.
Okay. Krista, I think you're back up. So the motion here doesn't... I'm a little confused by the motion.
I think we can take the whole regulations and seasons for elk motion. I think that would be okay, unless you want to split it out. And
so go back to this, to the other
or,
first page.
Just, is there a motion to adopt the proposed regulations and season dates for elk?
It is, but it doesn't have the alternatives, it just is the proposed. Does that mean it's the staff recommended alternative?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I was clear on
what
we were voting on.
Before we
Commissioner
go,
Vigil.
I'd like to comment. I don't live in those DAUs, E30 and E31, but I'm in E33, which is not very far away on the Colorado-New Mexico border. And I've seen a crash of elk in the last 3-4 years. I'm just amazed when I look out of my house towards my hay fields and a south-facing slope that faces me, and there is not a single elk track there. When 5 years ago, there was no snow left because herds of elk were coming down into my hay field. So the herds are crashing, and not just in these areas, but in a lot of different places. I just want to make that comment before we go, before we vote.
Thank you. Commissioner Hauser and then Commissioner Garcia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is the right time to ask this question and who would answer it, but just recognizing all the public comment we got on this, I mean, we got flooded with emails. A particular theme was equity between rifle and archery forms of, and so I just, it would be helpful to hear the science or the reasoning behind sort of those stakeholder groups or those constituent groups and the methodology behind the recommendation. I'd like to hear it. If we've heard it, I'd like to hear it again.
Thank you, Commissioner Hauser. I think I'm going to call up our local expert.
Thank you.
Afternoon, Commissioners, Madam Chair, Directors. Corey Chick, Southwest Region Manager. The science behind this was really pushed to the big game season structure to where we were looking specifically at archery. I mean, could this be extrapolated or also addressed within that second and third rifle? Yes, it always could, but this was specifically related to the BGS through the archery season.
That.
I'm sorry if I didn't
sure.
answer your question.
I still just generally sort of the kind of philosophical pushback we got on sort of two branches of sort of hunters and their form of hunting and equity sort of across the board on were archery hunters being sort of picked on, and at the sure. expense of rifle hunters. I'd just like to hear a little bit about sort of what went into that and recognize that we've talked about this at other meetings, but given the amount, the flood of public comment we got on this, it would be helpful to hear the rationale and help us walk through that.
And I may need help on some of the big game season structure discussion, but even if you look back in the history as far as equity, as these populations crashed, both the field and the biologist made decisions and directions on decreasing of cow harvest to the extent that the majority of that, up to about 75% of the cow licenses, were removed from muzzleloader and rifle seasons. So it was more of how much more can you impact that, and again. From the biological standpoint, that's why we made the change to limited sex specific on the archery, and then not hearing the same response from second and third rifle hunters about overcrowding. What we were hearing through the big game season structure was related specifically to archery, if that answers your question more.
Director Prenzel also had some comments. I don't know if you want to.
Go ahead first.
Okay. I might just add to that. That's a great question, but it's a very broad question on equity between seasons and dates and method of take. I'll hit a couple just real broad examples. Rifle hunting cow elk has always been limited, and archery hunting, it's been unlimited over the counter. That's obviously a change here. So there's been a disparity. That way, rifle hunters have been effective, and so cows have always been limited in that regard. Muzzleloaders is a limited tag, not an unlimited tag. So that's one kind of thing. There's Commissioner Haskett can talk about it. Just as an example, in the White River, years ago, and there was lots of elk getting, Mr. Phelps brought it up, elk were getting moved early in the seasons, the limited archery season, but it's still an over-the-counter in second and third season, but first season is limited for rifle and fourth season is limited for rifle. So there, it's what I would call tools in the toolbox, lots of different menus, and this one's zoning in specifically on that one, trying to adjust. The cows are already limited in these units for rifle, and so one of the bigger discussions in all this, I'm sure in your cornucopia of emails, is that you could leave it unlimited bull and limited cow. That is an option. That was an E16. That's still a tool potentially in the toolbox. That wasn't the recommendation for this unit due to elk numbers. So it was bull and cow.
Commissioner Haskett, and then I was going to say, Commissioner Hauser, do you want to respond first? Or?
Well, Commissioner Haskett may address this as well, but okay. I just felt like we needed sort of on the record a response given sort of the volume and the sort of the theme that was pretty prevalent in at least the email that came to me. I suspect it came to everyone. So thank you for putting that in the record and responding.
Commissioner Haskett.
Director Prenzel did hit on the cow. So rifle hunters have had a draw for cow licenses for a long time, but there's a couple other things. Archery is during the rut, and they also get to hunt for an entire month, and rifle hunters hunt for I don't know what our longest season is now, 9 days, 11 days. Most of them are 5 days. So there's a big difference there. It's different times of year. You can't really say this is equal to this. But I think the biggest thing we need to remember is we're here to manage the wildlife, and we need tools, and we're trying to give the tools and see how it works. In the White River herd, it was proven that during archery season, the archers push those animals onto private land and out. And that doesn't help us in the end either, because then we don't get a harvest for the rifle seasons or the archery season. So. And things are changing on the landscape. We're definitely seeing a decrease in our herd, so we've got to start somewhere.
Commissioner Adams, and then Commissioner Bright.
As a budding hunter, I would like to say that I have more of enjoy these moments where I don't know as much as I will soon. but the bit I do know is that archery is a less effective form of take. So I also just want to remind folks that, you know, equity is not equality, which means that we're not asking necessarily for the same numbers of limit, you know, archery versus rifle. So I think this also speaks to the comment that I made earlier around revisiting the way that we're doing our herd management planning. Talking about archery over here and then talking about muzzleloaders over there and then talking about, you know, rifles over there, it just seems like a very disconnected conversation. And in all of them, the result is the elk herd is declining. I think what can we do on the communication front, going back to what Commissioner Bletcher said earlier today, how are we communicating to the public the decline in the elk herd, and how are we communicating that everyone is going to take a hit and not just the archery folks or the muzzleloaders or the folks who are dealing with rifles as well. So I think there's a couple of different opportunities as we look to May when that conversation starts to restructure how we're doing that both regionally as well as the different forms of take. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Adams. Commissioner Bray.
Yeah, thank you. I'm trying to respond a little bit to Commissioner Hauser's question because I think it goes, you know, there's a perceived fairness issue here, I guess, is for lack of a better word. And I want to point out, at least in my mind, we're talking about two different things. Archery bull and rifle bull, they're really two different things. But at the same time, I think this will start the conversation as to whether where we're going with our unlimited over-the-counter elk units, because I think you're going to start seeing the same social issue that limiting the bull and these archery hunters is largely due to the social problems we're facing down there, overcrowding. It also, archery, the month of September is a beautiful month. Every outdoor enthusiast in the world's out there. Not, there's still that issue during rifle hunts, but not to the degree after school starts and a lot of that. So we're kind of trying to compare apples and oranges here, which is not very good. But to your point, Commissioner Hauser, we are going to have to probably start taking a look at our over-the-counter elk units and where that goes. But this isn't the time nor the place to have that conversation right this minute. but we can start thinking about how we want to have that. Because if you think this one's contentious, wait till that one comes up. So, that's my two cents.
Thank you, Commissioner Bray. Any other questions, comments? Are we ready to take a vote? Okay. Thank you, Corey.
I think, Madam Chair, if I may suggest, it might be clearer, just for the record, if we take a vote on this specific topic first.
Yes.
So perhaps you could make a motion just to adopt the regulations to create limited sex-specific licenses for archery elk hunting in E16, E24, E30, and E31.
As recommended by staff.
As recommended by staff.
Okay. Moved by Commissioner Haskett, second by Commissioner Vigil. Let's do a roll call, Laura, if you don't mind.
Adams?
Yes.
Blessa?
Yes.
Bray?
Yes.
Garcia?
Yes.
Haskett?
Yes.
Hauser?
Yes.
McDaniel is absent. Schaefer?
Yes.
Vardy?
Yes.
Vigil?
Yes.
Chair Zimmerman?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you. And then is there a motion to adopt the proposed regulations, the edits to the regs, and season dates for elk? That's a separate, well, it'll be logged as a separate vote.
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Vigil, second by Commissioner Haskett. We'll do a voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Thank you, Krista. We are on to pronghorn moose.
Yeah.
And then the administrative changes. And we got about an hour to make up. Let's go.
All right. Pronghorn is very easy. We have just extended the late doe pronghorn season in GMUs 9 and 191 to the end of January. You can find that change on page 196. That's all I have for pronghorn.
Okay. Any public comments specific to pronghorn? Commissioner discussion? Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your time, your public comments, and for making the time to join us today. All right, is there a motion to adopt proposed regulations and season dates for pronghorn?
So moved.
So moved by Commissioner Schaefer. Second?
Second.
Commissioner Garcia, we can do a voice call vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay.
All right, moving on to moose. The first change you'll see is separating GMUs 50 and 501 from current moose hunt codes, and creating a new moose hunt code that includes GMUs 50, 51, 59, 511, and 581. You can find those changes on page 202, 203, and 215. Next, you'll find adding archery, muzzleloader, and rifle antlerless moose hunt codes east of the peak-to-peak highway in GMU 38. That change is found on page 203. Next, we have separating GMUs 361 from GMU 36 for antlered hunt codes and creating antlerless moose hunt codes for both units, page 203 and 215. Then we have creating antlerless moose licenses for GMU 76 on page 204. And finally, converting the antlered moose license in GMU 65 to an either sex license. That's on page 215. Those are all the proposed changes I have for moose.
Thank you, Krista. Any public comment related to the changes in regs for moose? Commissioner discussion? Okay. Is there a motion to adopt proposed regulations related to season dates for moose?
So moved.
Second.
Commissioner Garcia and Commissioner Schaefer, thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thanks, Krista. Administrative changes.
Sure, yeah. And finally, as Commissioner Garcia pointed out, there are a number of small administrative cleanups throughout the chapter, related to things that are, you know, have been omitted from last year, or typos, things like that. And so I think we do need you all to approve those changes as well.
Okay. I don't think there's going to be any public comment or discussion on that. Is there a motion to adopt all other annual changes to Chapter W-2 not previously voted on, including but not limited to administrative changes as proposed by staff?
Yes.
Commissioner Vigil, second.
Second.
Commissioner Schaefer, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Krista, thank you. Mm-hmm. The next agenda item is 13. Jeff, I think we're going to try to move that to maybe tomorrow, Species Conservation Trust. Or do you want to try to talk about that now? Let's go.
Good afternoon, everybody. Yeah, we're on item, in your agenda, item 13. Time-wise, we're ready to start item 19, so I will be brief. Each year I come before you with a proposal to approve funding as requested by DNR. That'll become a bill in the legislative session to fund conservation work for species of concern, state or federally listed threatened species, candidate species, and so forth. So the memo is fairly explanatory. Basically, we have our categories are we have two categories of funding. Together, they equate to up to $2 million. How much money is actually available depends on how severance tax revenues come into the state, and this is a portion of that that goes to this program. Water Conservation Board also has a similar proposal before their board to fund South Platte River recovery and selenium issues on the West Slope. So basically, you can see the aquatic ones are in more detail. The terrestrial ones, it's kind of a catch-all. About 80% of the money earmarked for the terrestrial project in the coming legislative session would be for two species, Gunnison sage-grouse. As you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service is working on a recovery plan. We would like to have monies available to help us implement the highest priority recovery actions once that plan is finalized. The second species is a black rail, which most people are not familiar with. It's a small, secretive marsh bird that lives primarily on the Gulf and Atlantic coast of this country, although there are some interior populations. One of those is in southeastern Colorado. It was proposed to be listed by the Fish and Wildlife Service as threatened in 2018. They have yet to issue a final rule. We would like to get more information on this species to help inform their listing decision. We did a little bit of work with this money in 2018 and 19 and found that there appears to be a fairly robust population along the Arkansas River in the cattail habitats, and we'd like to learn more about whether they're breeding there and recruiting into the population, and this funding source will help us do that.
Thank you. We can now list speed talking to your long list of skills and abilities.
I've been training under Justin Rudder. So.
Appreciate any questions or comments. Commissioner Garcia.
I know you wanted to be brief, but you got all dressed up, so I'm just curious. It says in the very beginning here, and just help me here, that recommendation is to forward a statement of concurrence to the CWCB. Could you tell me what that means?
Yeah, because the bill that will eventually be introduced includes $4 million of funding, $2 million of which is earmarked for the Water Conservation Board and $2 million for projects that CPW staff undertake. And so we want to let the board know that this body is supporting our recommendations, and then we'll forward that on to DNR. And the Water Conservation Board meets later this month, and they'll do the same. So it's just a reciprocal, keeping them informed. Hopefully we're all on the same page.
And second is, could you just help me? I wasn't the cutthroat trout disease. Is this something I need to be worried about?
Person interested in fish conservation or a person who consumes fish? No, human health, you don't have to worry about it.
No,
there are no bacterial kidney disease is one of the things that we're wanting to spend money on. Of course, whirling disease is something we've been dealing with for quite some time. So it's sort of, there are a number of disease-related projects on the aquatic side that this will help fund, but bacterial kidney disease or BKD in salmonids, which includes trout, is one of the priorities, and it's an issue primarily in hatchery production, and so trying to get at ways to manage that disease.
Commissioner Adams.
Thank you. Briefly, I look forward to the agenda item on research overview. I just feel in general that I don't have a good handle on our research agenda as an agency, specifically the prior research, how to get access to that, the current research projects that are happening, and then the proposed, and then, of course, the link back to our strategic plan and the strategic priorities. So just moving forward, it would just really be helpful to see how all these pieces come together. So I know that, as I mentioned, there's a research overview coming up tomorrow morning, and I look forward to getting a better opportunity to understand how does this piece fit into the larger research agenda for the agency. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you want me to say a little something about that possibility tomorrow morning?
Sure.
Given where you are in your agenda today, and that we reserve the right to provide you a handout, I think that's what I'm going to do in the morning, is give you a handout. The request for that presentation was focused on our elk recruitment research, our elk and recreation impact research, and on the two predator studies on the Piceance and the Arkansas. So that's really the kind of the four project areas that were included in that update. Be happy to send you between now and March and schedule for a future meeting a larger overview of that runs the gamut of our terrestrial and aquatic research. And I actually have a document at the printers that we would like to provide you that kind of gives you a large overview of all the research we're doing and have done since the inception of the agency, actually.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Again, it also speaks to our opportunity to share with the public what we've been doing and how we're using our funds. Thank you.
Well, sorry, I had one other follow-up question on that, but I was writing that down at the same time. Now I can't remember. Oh, that handout. Because it is noticed on the agenda that it would have been a public presentation, is that handout going to be available online or somewhere?
Yeah, I'll have copies in the back, and they'll be a part of the archive online.
Okay. Thank you. This is an action item. Any other commissioner questions or comments? Any public comment since this is action item? Look at me, Jake. I'm getting better at it. Okay. Is there a motion to accept the recommendations for the Species Conservation Trust Fund as presented by staff? Thank you. Commissioner Vigil, a second?
Second.
Commissioner Haskett, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Opposed? Commissioners Vardy and Blecka, I'm sorry. I will look to the right, I promise.
We're going to work it out.
Okay. Throw something at me. I don't know. Okay, Krista, you're back up. Let's see where we can get to.
Okay, sounds good. So I believe we are on agenda item 15. We're now talking about issue identification. Agenda item 15 is chapter P7, passes, permits, and registrations, and also related provisions of chapter P1. The issue at hand is expanding the division's ability to issue special activity permits to commercial users. You'll find this on page 1. So current regulations in P7 authorize only non-commercial permits. There's a lack of regulatory authority to issue special activities permits for commercial events and activities. And this results in park managers relying on agreements or contracts to authorize the event and unnecessarily exposes CPW to claims by the organizer of the event.
Thank you.
The proposed changes to P7 and P1 would enable park managers to issue a permit regardless of whether the activity was commercial or non-commercial in nature. The proposed changes also ensure consistency between the permit appeal process and the State Administrative Procedures Act. And the draft redline version of these changes in P7 and P1 can be seen on pages 3 through 6, including a fee schedule for the Arkansas Headwaters Recreation Area on page 5. And that is all I have for you for agenda item 15.
And these are issue identifications, so we don't need to take action. Commissioner Garcia.
I'm going to direct this to Mr. Matter. Mr. Matter, I think you're the author of this. And you really do believe that this, does it eliminate their exposure or just dramatically decrease? You're concerned about our exposure, right?
Yes. So when the commission or division enters into a contract, you're subject to a greater statute of limitations and not protected by the Governmental Immunity Act.
Right.
Whereas when you issue a license or a permit to an individual, I think you're squarely under the Governmental Immunity Act and are also have the benefit of very clear sort of appeal procedures within the State Administrative Procedures Act. So rather than entering into a contract allowing a third party to enter onto the land owned or managed by CPW, you could issue a permit, which is effectively a license, and a license merely provides the terms and conditions under which a third party can use the land of another.
Sure. Thank you.
Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any current regs in regards to commercial activities or commercial sort of events at state parks? Do we need to have that corresponding to this sort of administrative change?
This piece, the existing rules contemplate the issuance of special activity permits to non-commercial users, and commercial users under existing rules are obligated to enter into a contract with the division or the commission. And I don't think there is a great deal of specificity concerning the nature of a commercial activity. In other words, these are the rules that apply if you have a commercial event with 10 people versus these are the rules that apply if you have a commercial event with 1,000 people. But I think this permit process enables the division to assess those impacts on a case-by-case basis and require the permittee to pay any study costs or mitigation associated with the commercial activity instead of foisting that burden onto the division.
Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, then great. My concern was simply by raising that there is now a commercial permitting process if there isn't the sideboards provided to allow staff to say these are the things you need to do as part of your application. I don't know if that needs to be regulatory in nature, if it could be done as part of that permitting process itself. Whichever way, I only care about the outcome.
No, I think it's the latter. It can be on a case-by-case basis. That permit could be issued with conditions, and there's no limit on the conditions that you can impose, you know, whether it's security or toilets or fencing. You know, that's a case-by-case determination that would be possible under this change.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next one.
All right, moving on to item 16, which is chapter W5, small game and migratory birds. This is kind of salmon orange in color on your devices. It's again at issue stage. So the chapter is open for consideration of annual changes to waterfowl and migratory bird hunting seasons and related provisions, including season dates, bag and possession limits, manner of take. And so we have provided for you some proposed migratory game bird seasons for Colorado in 2020 to 2021. That's on page one. These summary sheets show the recommended changes and proposed calendars for migratory birds to comply with the proposed federal regulation frameworks. The final frameworks will be published in January 2020. One of the major changes to note is the SCOP daily bag limit has been decreased from 3 to 2 in the Pacific Flyway and from 3 to 1 in the Central Flyway. In addition to that, we have one issue paper which proposes expanding current youth waterfowl days to also permit waterfowl hunting by veterans and active duty military members. This is on page 13. So the federal frameworks have allowed states to have 2 days of waterfowl hunting for youth hunters. And now new federal regulations allow states to have up to 2 additional days to allocate to veterans and active duty military hunters. These days could be the same for youth and veterans, and they are subtracted from the total number of season dates allowed annually. Staff proposed modifying the existing youth waterfowl hunting weekends to also allow hunting by veterans and active duty, active military, beginning with the 2020 to 2021 season. And that is all I have for you for agenda item 16.
Okay. Commissioner Garcia.
So I'm the clacker in the group, and so I was looking, and this is picky, but if you look at page 2, it says that if you go down the dark goose zone, what is it, northern front range dark goose, it says that the number of days in between 2019 and 2020, it went from 19 days down to 12 days, but yet it, if you look at the calendar dates, October 3rd to 21st and October 5th to 23rd, they're the same amount of days. So it doesn't compute. And so, and then there's another one down with the light goose at the very end there, conservation order. It says 75 and 72 days, but we only shortened it by 2. It's not a big deal, but I think if this stuff is going out for the public, I just want to make sure that the numbers are right. So maybe we could go back and take a look and make sure we've got that. And I'm not going to go through and look at, I started to look at the calendars that follow this to see if the calendars actually, all these coded calendars correspond. But unless I printed them and did it side by side, and I was already tired enough, I'm not going to go through that. Maybe it's something we could have an intern, some student or something, just kind of proofread these things to make sure that we don't have those kind of just clerical errors throughout.
Thank you for your comments. Yeah.
I can give my colleague
Krista's searching. She's on the phone, friend. Ask someone in the audience.
Is there anything we need to add to that, Jim? Okay.
Sounds like cleanup before it comes back to us for action.
Yeah, we'll make those changes and look through that. Thank you for finding that.
And my only real question was, does somebody want to tell me why our scalp numbers are down?
Again, I will turn to my colleague, Jim Gammonly.
The duck guy?
Thank you, Madam Commissioner, Commissioners, Director Prenslow, and Director Gibbs. I'm Jim Gammonly. I'm the avian research leader for CPW. The SCOP, there's a continental SCOP strategy, harvest strategy that's set by the flyways of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the prescriptions each year for the bag limits and season lengths are based on updated information on SCOP numbers. And it's a pretty volatile harvest strategy that the numbers bounce around quite a bit, depending on what the continental estimates of the breeding population are and the harvest each year is. The Fish and Wildlife Service and the flyways are working on trying to revise that strategy so it doesn't bounce around so much, but that's why. In that case, we're just simply adapting to the expected federal framework regulations.
I assume that. I just, last year we had pintails, this year it's scout.
Right. Both of those strategies are problematic, and we're trying to work to make them more, a little bit more stable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Adams.
I just had a quick question about the impact of, as a sister of someone in the active military, I'm all for increasing and expanding the opportunity to veterans in active military. However, I'm curious about the impact that that has to the experience for youth. I did see that there was an additional 2 days, but just curious how you and your team thought about what data points did you use to inform this as it relates to the number of youth that are currently using it, and then the impact of or the potential of additional veterans in active military. I mean, that's a large number of people, so I'm just curious how those conversations went.
That's a good question. I guess I can just try to answer it, and then I might ask my colleagues again. But, I don't believe that we have a whole lot of information on current participation in youth days currently. And so I think, they would just be broad estimates at this point. I think we are trying to collect more information, and we also don't have information on the current interest among veterans and active military personnel. So it is kind of a trial run, I think, at this point. Some anecdotal information from other states about the interest among veterans and active duty military. But to be perfectly honest, we don't have a whole lot of information.
Yes, that's the question, Commissioner Adams, that we're going to be trying to look at. This proposal is based on new federal legislation that just started last year. Most states didn't have time to even try and address this last season, or the season that we're in right now. One state that did was able to implement military days, and they did the same thing. This was North Dakota, did the same thing where they just added military hunters to the youth weekend that they have. North Dakota is another state that has a lot of military members in the state, a lot of active hunting military members, and they tried to put together a survey to estimate participation in harvest during the first year and kind of routed that around to the other states. One of the problems is it's hard to get a good sampling frame of active military or veterans to sample from to see whether they participated or not. And that's something that we're talking about internally to try and figure out a good way to do that. So we'll be, and North Dakota found that they had, decent participation as best as they could estimate. Not kind of overwhelming to any degree, but they certainly reported their numbers with the caveat that they didn't have a very good sampling frame to get those estimates from. So we're working on that, and I think that's, if this goes forward, if you approve this, that's something that staff will be discussing about how we can kind of look at what the participation and harvest coming from the active military and veteran hunters are.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Krista, on to agenda item 17. You get to channel Brett Ackerman and Daniel Eisenhart, formerly exemplified abilities to make up an hour.
Yeah, okay, no pressure. Yeah. Yes, agenda item 17, chapter W9, wildlife properties, and also related provisions of chapter P1. So we have a number of issue papers for you, and I'll try to go through them as quickly as possible. The first one is prohibiting camping on state trust land properties for more than 14 consecutive days in a 45-day period, or leaving camp unattended for more than 48 hours on page one. CPW and the state land board have increasingly noticed campers occupying state trust land properties in excess of 30 days. This extended use conflicts with other uses authorized by the state land board and can lead to unsanitary and unsafe conditions. It's currently prohibited to leave a camp unattended for more than 48 hours and to camp for more than 14 days in a 45-day period on state wildlife areas, but existing regulations do not address unattended camps or the length of stay on state trust land properties. So staff recommend creating a regulation that prohibits leaving a camp, shelter, motor vehicle or trailer unattended for more than 48 hours, or camping or parking a travel trailer or camper on any one state trust land public access program property for more than 14 days in a 45-day period. And if adopted, staff would recommend removing the references to the 14-day camping limit in the East Carter Mountain and West Carter Mountain state trust land regulations. The next issue paper is authorizing the division director to execute short-term housing leases. This is on page three. Currently, any new housing lease for staff must go to the leadership team and to the Parks and Wildlife Commission for approval. This approval process usually takes 2 months or more and is not practical for short-term housing needs. Staff proposed changing the regulations to allow new housing leases that do not exceed 12 months be executed solely by the CPW director. The draft redline versions of these changes in Chapter W9 and P1 are included on page 4 and page 5. Now we'll move on to issue papers in the Northeast region. The first one is adjusting regulations related to the fishing closure at Banner Lake State Wildlife Area during waterfowl hunting seasons. This is on page 6. Currently, regulation prohibits fishing at Banner Lake State Wildlife Area from the opening of the first regular duck season through the last day of the regular waterfowl season. However, there has been a high violation rate among anglers, especially during the month of October, and staff have found the majority of the violations is due to a lack of knowledge about the dates of the duck hunting season. So staff proposed changing the regulation to read, fishing is prohibited from October 1st to February 28th for additional clarity. Next we have allowing night fishing during certain times of the year at Jackson Lake State Wildlife Area, on page 7. Jackson Lake State Wildlife Area has good fishing access, and it was a well-known night fishing destination. The public has requested night fishing be allowed again, so staff proposed changing the regulation to read, public access is prohibited from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., except for legal fishing activities. Next, requiring hunting reservations for weekends and holidays during the teal season and the first split of the regular duck season at Jackson Lake State Wildlife Area. This is on page 8. Waterfowl hunters are currently not required to have reservations to hunt at Jackson Lake State Wildlife Area, which results in more hunters than the available hunt areas can accommodate, regulatory violations, and public safety concerns. This is especially true during the weekends of the teal season and the first split of the regular duck season. Staff proposed changing regulations to require reservations on Saturdays, Sundays, and legal holidays to hunt waterfowl during the teal season and the first split of the regular duck season. And also to add a regulation to require waterfowl hunters to check in and out at the check station. Hunters may not check in until 4 a.m. and can only hunt the area reserved. Let's see. So moving on to the Northwest region, we have several issue papers, which you'll probably notice, which are asking to add properties to the hunter reservation system. So I'm going to try to talk about them globally so we can save a little bit of time. So several properties you can see where we have access easements, which allow for very specific hunting opportunities. Previously, these hunting opportunities were allocated via an application system and or a random hand draw. So to simplify this process, staff is proposing adding these properties to the hunter reservation system through IPAWS, and to adopt property-specific regulations that are consistent with the access easement at each property. So in general, the regulations on these properties would state that hunting is restricted to specific species or types of animals. Hunting access is by reservation only, and reservation holders must have their confirmation letter with them while hunting on the property. Reservations may be obtained through the hunter reservation system and generally may be made up to 45 days in advance of the start of the specific season for which they are permitted to hunt on that property. To make a reservation, hunters must already possess an eligible license for a specific hunt code, which is permitted on that property. Hunters may be accompanied by a limited number of people. Hunters may only access the property on the date specified on the reservation. Vehicle use is generally limited or restricted. And overnight camping, dogs, fires, fishing, wood cutting, target shooting, building permanent blinds, and gathering artifacts are prohibited on those properties. So I'll just walk through those properties really quickly for you so you can follow along. The first one is Pot Creek State Wildlife Area. This is also known as Bobcat Ranch. So CPW manages limited public access hunting on Bobcat Ranch. Currently, that includes 4 cow elk hunters, which are allowed each year on that property. The next one is the Collins Mountain Ranch State Wildlife Area. So again, CPW manages a public access easement there, which allows 5 total hunters to hunt each year, including 1 antlered deer, 1 antlered elk, and 3 antlerless elk. The next one is Crooked Wash Ranch. Again, CPW has an access easement that allows 4 hunters per year. That includes 2 antlerless elk hunters during the muzzleloader season and 2 antlerless elk hunters during the first rifle season. The next one is Flanders Ranch State Wildlife Area. So you've probably heard of this one. We recently obtained an access easement there and added it as a state wildlife area. So staff would like to add big game hunting and waterfowl hunting on this property to the hunter reservation system and add property-specific regulations, as I've described. The next one is the Grand Valley Area Special Archery Hunt. CPW has been operating special archery hunts in several Grand Valley Area wildlife areas, including Tillman Bishop State Wildlife Area, Orchard Mesa State Wildlife Area, and Grand Junction Wildlife Area. Which in conjunction with the Bureau of Reclamation. They've been doing this since the early 2000s. So the access agreement allows for 1 hunter per week during regular archery season and 1 hunter per property for the second and third rifle season. The next one is the Louisiana Purchase Ranch. CPW obtained an access easement with the Louisiana Purchase Ranch to allow 6 hunters to access the property in the second and third rifle seasons each year. So 1 hunter of antlered deer, 2 hunters of antlerless deer, 1 hunter of antlered elk, and 2 hunters of antlerless elk. And the final one is Yarmany Ranch. So this is adding property-specific regulations to Yarmany Ranch State Wildlife Area. Yarmany Ranch is accessible for big game hunting through an access easement. Again, hunting is restricted to a limited number of elk, moose, pronghorn hunters through a hand draw process. So staff opted not to include this one in the hunter reservation system due to its complexity. So it'll still be conducted through a hand draw process, which will be conducted at the CPW Steamboat Springs Service Center, and also to adopt property-specific regulations as required by that easement. And the final one for the Northwest region is changing the hours of operation for the Basalt State Wildlife Area Public Shooting Range. This is on page 25. The current hours for the Basalt State Wildlife Area Public Shooting Range are 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, and 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. These hours are not consistent, however, with the seasonal daylight hours. And additionally, facilities and infrastructure associated with the power companies are located behind the shooting range, and staff frequently have to arrange temporary closures to ensure the safety of the power company personnel. Staff would like to create 2 sets of hours of operation and include a predictable day of closure to accommodate this maintenance. So summer hours would be from March 15th to October 14th, and they would be 7 a.m. until 7 p.m., Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, and then 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. Winter hours would run from October 15th through March 14th, and would be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. Wednesday would be closed for maintenance. Those are the issue papers for the Northwest region.
Thank you, Krista. Commissioner Garcia.
I have a couple of questions for Manager Leslie, if I could, please.
I know there's a few more still in this section, Krista.
Mr. Garcia, Mark Leslie, Northeast Region Manager.
So I know that us fishermen sometimes have difficulty understanding waterfowl regs. And so I understand what you did over at Banner Lakes in trying to help us without having to understand waterfowl by just giving us February 28th as a date. But then I look, and the Jackson Lake fishermen are so much smarter that with them, they can night fish up through the dark goose season. And so I guess they understand waterfowl, or should we change that one to February 28th?
Those are both loaded questions, and I'm not sure I want to even attempt that.
But seriously, should
different,
we just
different demographic. At Banner Lakes, the ponds freeze up, you know, generally for, you know, the waterfowl season, and then it's over. But we don't want fishermen and waterfowl hunters out there at the same time, because we've got people set up on ducks, and if the ponds are still open in October and duck season's going on, we've got conflicts. Which is kind of the same thing we were doing at Jackson Lake with the reservation issue. This is all stemming from inner conflicts with different users out there. So that's the reason.
Is there any reason that you wouldn't want to just use a set date like February 28th for Jackson Lake as well, as opposed to saying through the goose season and you have to keep?
You mean at Banner?
I mean, you did it at Banner. You
right.
Want to do it at Banner. Why not just do the same thing at Jackson, is what I'm suggesting.
Well,
just have a date, February 28th.
That's workable. We could do it if you wanted to do it that way. We submitted it the way we did because we were trying to address that particular issue. So that's all.
And my bigger question
not
is on Jackson Lake. I really like the idea of the reservation system. I'm just curious why you don't want to do it all the time.
We had that discussion, and in this particular case, I'm willing to go incrementally on it to not be so restrictive. But, you know, one thing I want to keep an eye on, and I talked to Area Wildlife Manager Todd Schmidt about this, is that if we do this, I don't want fights to break out on Fridays now. You know, they may move the fist fight from Saturday and Sunday to Friday. So we're going to keep an eye on that one. I don't want to keep coming back to all of you with changes, but we thought that was better to go incrementally on it.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you. Commissioner Adams.
Thank you. As a new fisherwoman, I would like to just say that I concur with Commissioner Garcia's request of just having dates as opposed to, you know, seasonal or, you know, the current language, just for transparency and just easier access, as we are going to see an increase of new anglers coming in and new participants into the outdoors persons. I think it's really critical that we try and be as user-friendly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Krista, I know you've got, I think, three or four more issue papers to get through.
Yeah, thank you. So let's see, we can move on to the Southeast region, I believe. We have just a few issue papers. The first one is permitting hunting from August 15th to the end of February at Box Creek State Trust Land. This is on page 83 in the commission version of the packet, page 27 in the public version. There seems to be an increase of pronghorn in the upper Arkansas Valley, and public is asking for the start of date of the season on Box Creek State Trust Land to begin on August 15th, which is the opening of the over-the-counter archery season. Next is establishing visitor management regulations for Turkey Track Ranch State Trust Land, page 84 in your version, page 28. For the public. Parking has been a concern at Turkey Track Ranch State Trust Land, where hunting pressure is high. In 2019, CPW constructed two additional parking lots parking areas. However, vehicles continue to park on the sides of the road, causing safety concerns and resource impacts. Staff propose updating regulations 903A-168 to prohibit access from county roads. Additionally, because the property is primarily used for pronghorn hunting, staff proposes changing the access date to August 15th to February 28th. And additionally, staff would like to see the property limited to foot access only to minimize resource impacts and require that only portable blinds be used. The final one for that region is prohibiting the discharge of firearms at Mount Chauvineau State Wildlife Area from the upper end of the Mount Chauvineau State Fishing Unit downstream to the Highway 291 bridge crossing. There's a map in your version if you're at all confused by this. So currently discharging firearms is prohibited except when hunting from the Highway 291 bridge upstream to the property boundary on the Mount Chauvineau State Wildlife Area. The area from the upper end of the Mount Chauvineau State Fish Unit downstream to the Highway 291 bridge is near a residential area. There have been some safety concerns there, so staff is proposing limiting hunting on this portion of the Mount Chauvineau State Wildlife Area to handheld archery equipment and falconry. We'll move on to the Southwest region. The first issue paper is shortening the Gunnison sage grouse viewing season at Juanita Watchable Wildlife Area. This is page 88 in the commission version, page 32 in the public version. Juanita Watchable Wildlife Area is becoming increasingly popular for viewing Gunnison sage grouse, but there have been concerns about decreased use of the traditional lek there. Birds seem to be shifting display areas and breeding activities further from the developed watchable site. A subcommittee was formed to consider the impacts and evaluate alternatives with representatives from CPW, Gunnison County, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, stock growers, Siskiyou, and Western Colorado University. And as a preferred alternative, staff proposed opening the site from April 1st to April 30th, except during the second full week of the month. This would reduce the total viewing days from 45 to 23, but provide a period of no disturbance from the wildlife site during the typical peak of breeding activity. It also allows for continued public viewing opportunity in a controlled manner. If approved, it's preferred that the regulation change be effective June 1st, 2020. The final issue paper for you in this section is requiring non-exempt boats to launch from the CPW boat ramp at Groundhog Reservoir State Wildlife Area. CPW has a perpetual access easement for public boating and fishing at Groundhog Reservoir State Wildlife Area. There have been increasing numbers of landowners launching boats from private property instead of the boat ramp. To minimize the potential of aquatic nuisance species introduction, staff proposed requiring all motorized and trailered boats to launch at the CPW boat ramp there. So that is all I have for you for agenda item, what are we on now? 17. Thank you.
Well done. Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few comments regarding couple things regarding the hunter reservation system on a bunch of these properties in the Northwest. I think it's a great move forward. One thing I'll call out though is that the access is being created through the habitat stamp program through the acquisition of easements on these properties. It'd be great to be ensure that they're all signed with the fact that the habitat stamp program is what is providing access, so there is an acknowledgement that sportsmen and women dollars are going towards this access creation. Secondly, it'd be great if we could better publicize that these opportunities exist. Now, I was on the Habitat Stamp Committee when we got access on all of these. I could not tell you at all until I read through the issue papers of what that access was. So I don't know if that's a case where it's in our big game brochure that there's a asterisk that says that there are private land, additional private land opportunities or what it may be. But being able to publicize that, I think, is a key to, one, you know, having a good utilization of the properties, but also continued support behind the Habitat Stamp program. Moving on the Juanita Watchable Wildlife, I think this is a great move. However, I would also like to see an actual trigger, adaptive management trigger regarding closure. At what point are high male counts is the response to close watchable wildlife programs there? And I understand, you know, stuff that Dr. McGee has been doing down there for decades, as well as the robust coalition of stakeholders that have been working on this, but this is something that we, from my own experience of running grouse tours over the years, there is an impact from running those tours, and we have to be able to agree upon a place where maybe it needs a full-scale rest. And then on the last comment, understand that the Monzima Valley Irrigation Company is the owner of Groundhog Reservoir. I'm just wondering if there's a middle ground approach where private property owners aren't told that they can't do something on their property. If there's a way to be able to get annex inspection, but not requiring them to not be able to utilize their own property for launching. I'm not an authority by any means on this topic, but it does seem like that's a way to create some controversy.
Yeah, we can look into those issues for you. I don't know right off the top of my head.
Sounds like there'll be a little follow-up. Thank you, Commissioner Schaefer. Commissioner Hauser.
Madam Chair, and this concerns the basalt shooting range hours, so I don't know whether that's JT or Matt. First of all, I just want to say thank you. I recognize this has been a monumental exercise following the Lake Christine fire. It seems on its face that this is a great sort of compromise and move forward closer to Cameo and the opportunity to take advantage of daylight and changing seasons. The day off for maintenance work seems to make a whole lot of sense. So on its face, this seems like a great improvement. I guess my question to you both is, what are you hearing locally? Sort of what are the next steps? How might we test this? You know, is it a sort of a test period to see how this goes? Do we come back to if it doesn't work? And then sort of can you describe sort of what the long-term continued conversations with the community regarding the range might be? I assume this isn't sort of we zip it up with a bow and this is the end of the discussion. So thanks.
Great question. JT Ramaski, Northwest Regional Manager, Commissioner Hauser, and all the commissioners, one, thanks for the support on this. And it wouldn't have been done without the staff locally. Matt Yamashita is here as well, so we can get into some specifics if you'd like. As you know, we had the task force. We moved through a lot of processes. Since the last couple meetings of the commission, we've also had an opportunity to sit down with the mayor and with the town manager and a few of the council folks up there in the town. I think we've had some very productive conversations. Matt has also committed to meet with them continually, one-on-one, for at least once a month. They're going to start developing a strategic plan, if you will, about their community and about their neighbors, which we're one of the largest, and they acknowledge some of our constraints and also some of our needs. And so I think we've hugely moved that needle, most part because of Matt and his staff. There's going to be continual work that needs to be done here. Nothing is in stone, I'll say. I think this is best to be left as adaptive management through time, and we're going to continue to work and engage with the task force group, look at other ways to ameliorate noise, and we're still looking at lead and other things out there. We're looking at alternative locations, so all those bigger, broader things are also still ongoing. Just really quickly, I want to give Matt a second to talk because I'm sure he may have a couple other things, if you don't mind, so I'll ask Matt to.
Thanks, JT. Commissioner Hauser, Madam Chair, Directors, Commissioners, appreciate the support. Just as JT had mentioned, just to address the specific question, as JT mentioned that I've been, me and my staff have been meeting with Town Council, with the Salt Town managers for at least once a month. We propose to do that continuing forward, and we, part of that process is with the understanding there's not a single answer that will fit everybody's needs in this kind of a situation. So we're hoping to stay openly engaged throughout this process, you know, part of that transparency and trying to achieve, you know, compromises where we can, but both recognizing that we have certain objectives that that will need to be accomplished. So we're hoping that throughout this open line of communication, that as we present papers like this, as we make changes and we start addressing topics of concern that people understand we are working. It's not an arbitrary decision made by one entity or the other, that we're doing this collaboratively, collectively, well thought out, well proposed, so that we can move toward some sort of a productive solution in the future. We as staff have already, for the next 2 to 3 years, have already delineated a number of projects on the property that will help address some of the concerns that have been raised, both as a result of just the shooting range being in close proximity to a municipality and in addition to the aftermath of the Lake Christine fire. Further beyond that, we haven't dismissed the proposition established by some of the citizens to look at alternative range sites. So that's something where we're continuing to stay engaged with both the task force that was convened in 2018 and also with the municipality, with Town of Assault, in order to look at items as they become available, just to dive into them, see if there is anything that potentially may come around. It's one of those projects that we'll handle on a case-by-case basis, and we're still open to suggestions is what it comes down to.
Just quick follow-up. The lack of or the absence of calls or emails about this prior to this meeting would suggest a couple of things. Perhaps this outline is generally acceptable or has been presented as a solid compromise in the community. So just could like to hear a little bit about that. And then secondarily, how will it be shared more broadly, given a pretty attentive couple of newspapers and media in the Roaring Fork Valley? And just, I also would wonder how we take advantage of the opportunity to get out in front of this from a public relations standpoint and to tell that story. I don't know if Commissioner Vardy has heard anything either. The absence of information, I think sometimes the vacuum will take over. So the opportunity as the stakeholders of that community understand that this has really been an exercise of finding a good compromise, which to me, this is a big movement. So how do we do that and sort of what's the plan?
As of right now, that's a good question. And right now, I think the basis for a lot of the silence has been our continued engagement with a lot of the entities that have had raised prior concerns and addressing that directly with them. As far as moving forward, this speaks to both sides of the coin. Throughout the whole process, we've kind of vowed to and continue to vow to maintain open lines of communication to all the different stakeholders that have been brought up, have raised their hands and shown that they have some interest in what we're doing. So we've been reaching out and speaking with them directly. We're going to continue to do that. Moving forward, I think in your packets there's some documents to show what thought process was going into this. Obviously, we want to highlight that there was a lot of thought behind this, and there's just good justification for why it's being proposed. It's not just because it felt good or felt right at a certain time. So that's part of the message that we're wanting to articulate and move forward. You're correct, Commissioner Hauser, that there are a lot of local media entities that are paying very close attention to any decisions being made regarding the shooting range and what staff or what the agency is proposing to do with the range. It's something that we would like to remain transparent in that regard. Locally in the Roaring Fork Valley, the communities that are going to be affected, they rely very heavily on printed media for whatever it may be. So we'll obviously be looking to reach out to them, and as this kind of continues to move along, utilize them as a resource to our benefit in getting word out to those communities and making sure that people understand where we've been, where we are, and where we plan to go.
Thanks. Just sort of one maybe final underscore in that often it's the folks that are at the table, and I think what your comment about sort of the silence is says a lot about those that have been at the table. I would certainly underscore the broader communication around this, because folks that even don't use the shooting range were part of that valley when that fire was pretty evident all across that region. So you'd want sort of folks on the same page, whether or not they're in Newcastle or they're in Aspen or you know, whatever at the appropriate time when you're ready to do that. Certainly that media relations, I think, could come back and reap good benefits. So thank you.
Thank you. Shows the, you know, definite commitment by the agency to stay involved in such a big issue. So thank you. And I will add my agreement, Commissioner Hauser, to make sure that we get that message out there to the community, to the entire valley. Thanks so much for all your work in that. So just a little agenda update, little agenda check-in. Since we are a bit behind, we're going to move agenda items 19 and 22 until tomorrow. Krista, I do want to cover 18 now, and then we will go to break, if that's right with Katie. And then we'll start with items 20 and 21 right after break. That works for everyone. Clear as mud. All right, Krista, agenda item 18.
Great, thank you. I'll try to be quick. Agenda item 18 is related to Chapter W16, which is the Parks and Wildlife Procedural Rules. So it's pink in color on your devices. And this involves revising the process by which the division and commission respond to citizen petitions for rulemaking. So current regulations related to citizen petitions, which you can find on page 3 of your packet, generally prompt staff to file a rulemaking notice with the Secretary of State if a complete citizen petition for rulemaking is filed on time. This presumes the commission will want to consider making regulatory changes and obligates the staff to analyze the petition without the benefit of any direction from the commission. In addition, current regulations grant citizen petitioners the opportunity to make oral presentations to the commission, which may not be necessary in all circumstances and somewhat limit CPW's ability to manage commission meeting agendas. Staff propose adopting regulations similar to other natural resource departments, which does not put a strict timeline on when citizen petitions would be noticed for rulemaking and does not automatically grant citizen petitioners the opportunity to make an oral presentation to the commission concerning their petition. However, citizens always have that right during public comment. The amendments suggested are intended to maximize CPW's flexibility in responding to citizen petitions while retaining the public's ability to bring forward proposed regulatory changes. These changes may necessitate a revision to the Commission's July 7, 2016 public rulemaking petition policy, the current version of which is included in your materials on page 4. We've also included a brief summary of several other departments and how they deal with citizen petitions for your reference on page 7. And I'd like to turn it over to Jake at this point for more information about this issue.
So this issue paper relates to discussion that was held in Ray. Director Prenslow mentioned that he was going to reevaluate the citizen petition process, and we've been working on this. Tomorrow, we have an executive session to discuss this in detail. I wanted to update the commission on some recent case law update and related issues, and it's really meant to maximize efficiency and address some of the concerns I have. So I hope that we can have a discussion tomorrow in executive session on that topic.
Sounds good. Thank you, Commissioner Garcia.
Mr. Matter, could you make available to at least me Rule 529?
Sure.
Great. We do have one public comment on this item, Krista. Is that all right? Are we ready to go to public comment? Okay. Andy Trehorn, are you here? Great. Congressional Sportsman Foundation. Thanks, Andy. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Commission, Andy Trehorn with the Congressional Sportsman Foundation. I have one brief comment for your consideration as you work through this process. I believe existing statutes under 24.6402 require only 24 hours of notice for a meeting to consider public business or formal actions. And to the Commission's credit and staff's credit, this body has always been pretty good about giving 10 days notice with agendas for Commission meetings. Given the predictable rulemaking cycle that you all use and when regulations come up in a pretty predictable fashion, it seems like there's ample opportunity for the public to plan on when they might want to attend a commission meeting. However, given that the nature of these citizen rulemaking petitions is fairly unpredictable, I think there are some concerns that I've heard and that I share about the ability to have adequate time to plan to attend a commission meeting with only 10 days notice when you don't know that a citizen's petition has been submitted to the agency. So with that in mind, as you work through this, I would respectfully request that you consider giving the public 30 days notice prior to placing any of these citizens' petitions on an agenda moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take that into consideration. Okay, let's move to a 10-minute break. Let's try to be back here at 3:40, and then hopefully we can make up some time. We're moving about 35 minutes to tomorrow, so we'll catch up. Thanks. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you again to our caterers. Some yummy snacks. Okay, Brett, thank you for being willing to bump till tomorrow. Katie, we're going to jump to agenda item 20.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Katie Lancer, Policy and Planning Supervisor for CPW. At the Commission's November meeting, the Commission requested information on state regulations on concepts of take wildlife, and that's the information I'm going to be relaying in this presentation. Wildlife contests are organized competitive contests where participants compete for cash or other prizes for removing wildlife in a specified location during a specified time period. Opinions about such contests vary. There are some that find such contests objectionable for the wildlife deaths incurred, the provision of rewards for wildlife take, and because they do not see a biological basis for such an approach. Contest proponents find that the contests are a cost-effective management tool, particularly for predators that are a threat to livestock, and that the contests provide a form of entertainment and recreation. In Colorado, we have a partial ban on wildlife contests. By statute, big game contests are prohibited, but contests are allowed for some species of small game and fur bears, provided that no more than five of each species is taken by any individual participant during the event. Laura, are you able to put up my slide deck? I have a map that I'd like to show you all, which kind of shows the status of wildlife contests across the U.S. Our initial analysis found that five states have some form of a ban on wildlife contests. Those states, when we have the map up, will be shown in purple. So in Arizona, California, and Massachusetts, banned predator and fur bear contests. New Mexico, Vermont, banned coyote contest. So again, those are the ones that are in purple on this map. The state shown in blue considered legislation in 2019 related to wildlife contest bans. Nevada and Oregon had legislation introduced to ban coyote contests, but those did not pass. In New Jersey, New York, and Wisconsin are considering legislation during their current legislative sessions. The state shown in yellow, like Colorado, have partial bans. These partial bans in some cases limit when prizes may be offered, the dollar value of prizes, where contests may occur, or require a permit from the state Fish and Wildlife Agency in order to hold a contest. More details are available in the memo that I wrote to the commission, which is also on the January meeting webpage. The states that are shown in white do not have a contest ban. The states in light gray did not have information available that we could find on a ban, but we did find information showing the contest had been held in that state in 2019. The state's color dark gray, we did not find information about contest bans or about contests in 2019. That's really the extent of my presentation. Just we can use the rest of our time for questions and discussion.
Thank you, Katie. Commissioner Blecka.
How many contests are held in Colorado annually?
That information is somewhat hard to find. I did do a web search and found evidence of at least one contest that was held in Colorado in 2019. I say it's somewhat hard to find because sometimes it may be just publicized on Facebook or something like that, so if you're not a member of the group, it can be hard to find, but I do believe at least one coyote contest was held in 2019 in Colorado.
Commissioner Blecka.
Okay, so in Jackson County, I know that the North Park stock growers use a coyote contest. And it's a fundraiser for their organization. So it's not just arbitrary, just for something to do. It actually has a focus for them. And a lot of that is, dual, like raising money, but also, protecting their livestock as well. And so I think that that part of being culturally important to these communities needs to be part of the conversation as well.
Commissioner Garcia.
Yeah, I just want to be careful, and I don't think this is aimed at it, but American Kennel Club, Hunting Retriever Club, a lot of bird dog clubs, we do a lot of contest-type hunting with small with birds. And I assume this is not in any way aimed at those type of activities.
So you want to know if, like, contests for birds are considered here?
If what?
You want, just to clarify, you want to know if contests for birds are covered under these provisions?
Yeah. I mean, those particular types of contests, I mean, they're very common all over the state year-round.
And I may need help from Jake Matter on this one. The way that I read it in our section 303 is about for small game and fur bearers. Jake, are you able to address fur bears?
I think that's an issue that I thought about a little bit when this discussion was starting. And I believe the answer is that when birds are released, for example, in a, you know, in a private club or facility, it's not wildlife. The state doesn't own the bird until the day after. So I don't think that this is, you know, the 303 provision does not address the issue that you're raising.
I'm looking at 303, and it says the tagging or make mark tag small game, but and it says where prizes are worth for the taking of small game and game birds.
I'd have to look at the definition of game birds, but I felt confident that it wouldn't affect the release at, you know, a private club due to the ownership change the day after. But you know, I think that's an important point that would need to be resolved if this were to proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Blessa.
I have general philosophical question. Is there any difference between this type of contest and a fishing contest?
Yeah. By statute, CPWs are, need to be careful here. The commission shall adopt rules which regulate the conduct of fishing contests in public waters of the state. So I think on the one hand, you're prohibited from holding a big game contest, but on the other hand, your statute contemplates and endorses and recognizes the importance of fishing contests.
Okay. Commissioner Adams.
Thank you for this additional information. I really appreciate having the state comparative information. I guess my biggest concern there is the limit of five, but there's not a limit of participants. So although I understand the economic impact for fundraising purposes, my concern is that there is not any kind of restriction or cap on how many participants. So, you know, five times 100 is 500. So, and again, depending on the species, et cetera. So I appreciate this conversation, and I look forward to further conversation. Thank you.
Commissioner, I may have this wrong, but I think it's my understanding that you can hunt, for example, coyotes year-round. Is it unlimited? So I don't see how having, you know, a big number of contestants in a particular contest would be any different than having the ability to do that year-round.
I think the issue for me is really the concentrated in one time period, and so the impact that that would have on that habitat and that, you know, species in that particular area versus having something all along the all across the year. But again, maybe this is something that is already on CPW's radar screen as far as monitoring that we conduct.
So I think what I'm hearing is understanding the difference between the sort of single hunters on the landscape with a, perhaps say a small game license versus having a contest and sort of the concentrated number of hunters in one place at one time.
Commissioner Schaefer and then Commissioner, Commissioner Adams.
I wanted to clarify.
Not just that, but also just the impact of having however X number of hunters in the same place and the impact that that would have on that particular species and then the impact that that has on the other species that may rely or are associated with that species. Thank you.
Commissioner Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think an issue of what's being discussed is in part game and non-game species. If we're talking about coyotes and prairie dogs and, you know, the litany of critters where we have bag and possession limits, I think that it's sort of an apples and oranges comparison that we were kind of getting into here. To me, it's one where I think those are, Commissioner Adams has some really valid concerns. I think the unlimited bag limit aspect of it, you know, makes it a little bit confusing. My question about moving forward is, you know, what are we trying to achieve and distilling that down into some specificity so that you guys can provide for, I think, some adequate feedback on what we can and can't do. Because to me, there's a big difference between non-game and game species in terms of those opportunities.
Thank you. Commissioner Hauser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Commissioner Bray or Haskett might chime in on this as well, but at our recent opportunity to be at the WAFA conference, there was some conversation among commissioners in the West about contests in general. And so it just may be, and I'm sure staff and everyone is doing that, to sort of monitor the kind of Western conversation around this and certainly sort of public sentiment around it. It was much more around predators, as I recall. And at the same time, you know, probably something that's going to come back to us. So anyway, I don't know if my colleagues want to chime in on that, but just a topic that was, we spent quite a bit of time on that, as I recall,
at WAFLA. Commissioner Bray.
Yeah, it's not a new subject. It comes up periodically. Most, as I understand, most of the other states that have restrictions focus on the monetary or the value of the prize sort of thing. That's where they don't necessarily outlaw it, like for function like you described, but they discourage big prizes. I think we need to study it. I think there's some examples where that it may be a contest, but it's socially acceptable and it can be a good thing. And there's others where it's not acceptable.
I'm sorry, Commissioner Gray, are you? I wonder if you're pausing or if you're finished.
No, I'll end it at that.
You're welcome to continue, or throw something at me if I don't look. If you raise your hand. Director Prenzel, I think, wanted to remind us where we are in this whole process as well.
Yeah, I think Commissioner Bray, obviously somewhat concurrence. That's the intent of this after a couple of commissioners on this board asked us to look into that. So obviously that's what Katie's doing. We want to have that discussion. I know we have some public discussion, and then staff will go back and take a deeper dive. And so you know, the intent of this is doing exactly what you're doing now. You know, have we thought of this? Should we look in this? You know, stay away from this, et cetera. Give us that kind of good direction, and we'll come back in a future date with that information. So, thank you.
And I do want to hear public comment. I also want to, Commissioner McDaniel, if you recall, this was something that he brought up in the past as well, and he did send me some notes. He just wanted to, you know, if he were here, he would say that he does support banning of all contest killings. So I just wanted to share that information. Any other commissioner comments? Obviously, we can have more comments after public as well, but anyone else? Katie, are you good? Are you ready for me to call public? Okay. All right. Aubin Royal with the Humane Society.
Good afternoon. Hi again. My name is Aubin Royal, and I'm the Colorado State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. We just want to thank the Commission for addressing this issue, and thank you to the agency staff for the presentation. This is something we feel very strongly about. And I want to start off by saying first that the Humane Society of the United States does not take a position on subsistence hunting. Rather, we work towards ending the cruel practices that many hunters agree violate the principles of sportsmanship, fair chase, and respect for wildlife and the environment.
One of those practices is wildlife hunting contests, organized events in which participants compete for cash and prizes for killing animals within a certain time period. Judging categories may focus on the number, weight, or the sex of animals killed, a tiered point system by species killed, or the smallest or largest body or body part size of animals killed. Contests are often sponsored by manufacturers or sellers of weapons, ammunition, rifle scopes, spotlights, and predator calling devices. Prizes are often a cash pot in addition to raffles for prizes including weapons and other equipment. Sometimes betting is allowed on the contestants themselves. Colorado has banned hunting contests for big game species, but the regulations still allow contests for the killing of up to five small game or fur bearer species, including coyotes and prairie dogs, per person per contest. The following are some examples of recent contests in Colorado. The High Desert Coyote Classic was held last weekend in Pueblo, offering a prize for the big, little, and ugliest dog. The check-in for the Song Dog Coyote Hunt that was held at the American Legion in Keensburg in December of 2019. The advertisements for last year's contest offered cash prizes for the most dogs and cash prizes for smallest and largest dog. As you can see, if they're advertising a prize for the most animals killed, it's likely that they're not sticking to the five-animal limit. The San Luis Valley Coyote Calling Competition was held the weekend before that in December of 2019. A coyote calling contest was held in November 29th to December 1st of 2018 in Walden, sponsored by the North Park Stock Growers. Its poster read, cash prizes for the top three teams and gift cards for the biggest male, biggest female, mangiest, and buyer's choice. In July of 2018, the Rocky Mountain Youth Project held a prairie dog shoot in Salida. A Howlin' for Heroes coyote killing contest was held in January 2016 in Loma. In an article about the Four Corners Predator Callers predator hunt in January 2016 in Cortez, a CPW spokesman was quoted as saying, we don't sponsor or condone or encourage these sorts of things. And the Heart of the Plains coyote calling contest in December of 2015 in Lyman targeted coyotes, bobcats, and swift fox. With this in mind, the HSUS asked the commission to strike the line that allows the five animal limit so we can see an end to these cruel and unsporting events in Colorado. Thank you.
Thank you, Avin. Any questions or comments? Okay. Johanna Hamburger.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Directors, Commissioners. Thank you very much for addressing this issue. My name is Johanna Hamburger. I'm a third-generation Coloradan based in Lakewood. I'm a wildlife attorney with a background in conservation biology, and I began working on wildlife issues in 2007. I'm speaking on behalf of the Animal Welfare Institute and Project Coyote. As we heard earlier, several states have banned certain types of wildlife killing contests. I will address why Arizona, Massachusetts, Vermont, and California have adopted these bans. The Arizona Game and Fish Commission initiated rulemaking banning contests for predator and fur-bearing species. They did this to address extensive public controversy and to regulate hunting activities in a way that is consistent with the Commission's duty to preserve wildlife for the beneficial use of the public. The Commission found that predator and fur-bearing hunting contests are contrary to the important principle that the take of wildlife should not be allowed to go to waste or taken for economic gain. The Massachusetts Division of Wildlife and Fisheries also initiated rulemaking that prohibited fur-bearer and predator contests. This was done to address public concerns that certain hunting contests are unethical, contribute to the waste of animals, and incentivize indiscriminate killing of wildlife. The division further stated that the regulations mandate ethical hunting practices that promote or sustain support for hunting by the general public. The division also found that coyote contests in particular did not manage the species or protect deer populations. The division stated hunting would not have an appreciable impact on coyote population size, and coyote predation on fawns and adult deer does not impact deer population size. The Vermont legislature banned coyote contests in response to public outrage. The process involved the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife issuing a report on coyote management, which stated, "We do not endorse contests because we do not believe that they have any long-term beneficial impact on coyote population, nor do they foster the respect deserved by any harvested animal." The department further stated, We do not believe that such short-term hunts will bolster populations of deer or other game species. The department was also concerned about the threat of polarization of the hunting and non-hunting communities. The department cited Tenet 4 of the North American model, which states wildlife can be killed only for a legitimate purpose, and found that contest failed to meet that standard. The California Fish and Game Commission banned contest targeting fur bearers and non-game mammals due to extensive public controversy. The commission found that offering inducements changes hunting behavior and does not reflect good sportsmanship. I respectfully urge the commission to consider these same factors and take action to implement a ban on killing contests for small game and fur bear species in our state. A ban is supported by 15 organizations with over 103,000 members in Colorado, and that letter is contained in your materials. Thank you very much for your time and for considering this request.
Thank you, Ms. Laris. Any questions? Okay. I'm sorry. I was looking at the next sheet. That was Ms. Hamburger. Lindsay Laris. Up next. Thank you.
Thank you, Commission and Madam Chair. Thank you for taking the time to consider this issue today. My name is Lindsay Laris. I am the Wildlife Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, and I live in Denver. We also have an office in Denver, and we have 10,000 members in the state who care about wildlife issues as well as preserving the environment. Nationally, we have about 200,000 members and supporters, many of whom recreate in Colorado, for whom this issue is very important. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about the process in New Mexico of what happened with killing contests and the ban that was just enacted. Guardians is a Santa Fe-based organization, so we've been involved in the process there for multiple years. Also, New Mexico is similarly culturally and politically to Colorado, so I thought it was a good state to talk about their process. As you all probably know, hunting and fishing is big business in New Mexico, the same way it is in Colorado. The state derives around $600 million from hunters and anglers. There's 86,000 hunters in the state and over 160,000 anglers. So this issue is not one that was taken lightly. Since 2015, there have been efforts to ban killing contests in the state. The bill finally passed in 2019 as applied to coyote killing contests only. And this has been a long effort, and I think I was looking at why did this pass at that time? What happened in 2019? I think New Mexico at the time recognized that this was not about hunting. It was about an ethical choice on how to hunt. And notably, in 2019, the bill had a conservative Republican sponsor named Mark Morez. This state senator has a 93% rating from the NRA on gun rights issues. He has multiple no votes on bills restricting access to guns. This is not somebody who is anti-hunting. This is somebody who is pro-hunting but sees coyote killing contests as something that is against ethical hunting. There was a lot of discussion during the session last year about these contests, and what it came down to were killing contests are about wanton violence and killing, not about ethical hunting, and there's a reason why these are distinct from hunting. The coyote killing contests represent violence, and therefore the ban on these passed by a bipartisan vote in New Mexico last year. Shortly before the vote, the State Land Commission issued an executive order banning coyote killing contests on state lands in New Mexico as well. I urge the Commission to follow the role of our sister state, New Mexico, and ban these cruel contests because they are different from ethical hunting and they have no place in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blair. Any questions? Okay, John Emmerich with Colorado School of Mines.
My name is John Emmerich. I'm an ecologist and a retired college professor from the Environmental Department at Colorado School of Mines. I lived most of my life in Colorado and presently live in the Crystal River Valley near Redstone, Colorado. I went to undergraduate school at the University of Washington, Seattle and received my PhD from the University of Colorado. And I've written a couple of books on Colorado ecology. So thank you very much for allowing me to comment on wildlife killing contests. I'm going to focus my comments on prairie dogs because they are a common target of wildlife killing contests in Colorado. But first, I would like to remind the commissioners of the State Wildlife Action Plan, otherwise known as SWAP, that was first implemented in 2005 by CPW to encourage and support conservation actions that address Colorado's species of greatest conservation need. The SWAP was revised in 2015, an effort that greatly strengthened scientific content of the plan and refined the conservation status of the listed species. SWAP presents a two-tier structure, with 55 species listed in Tier 1 being those which are truly of highest priority in the state, and 104 species listed in Tier 2. While the agency has judged the priority of Tier 2 species to be lower than Tier 1, Tier 2 species are still important in forestalling population trends and habitat or habitat conditions that might lead to a threatened or endangered listing status. Colorado has three prairie dog species, white-tailed prairie dog, Gunnison's prairie dog, and black-tailed prairie dog. The white-tailed and Gunnison's prairie dogs are West Slope species and are both listed as Tier 1 species. The black-tailed prairie dog is listed as a Tier 2 species. However, the SWAP doesn't present any analysis of what the decline of a Tier 2 species such as the black-tailed prairie dog would have on other species dependent on their activities. Prairie dogs are considered a keystone species because of their disproportionate impact on other species. They enhance the diversity of vegetation, vertebrates, and invertebrates, and enable the survival of species of concern, such as the black-footed ferret, swift fox, mountain plover, and burrowing owl, all Tier 1 species. Biodiversity may be at risk due to reductions in distribution occurrence of prairie dogs. As a result of habitat fragmentation and prairie dog eradication programs, colonies are now smaller and more susceptible to extirpation, primarily by sylvatic plague. Wildlife killing contests of prairie dogs significantly reduces populations of prairie dogs, not only by direct mortality, but by significant reproductive decline, abandonment of the colony, and disease. Shooting of prairie dogs causes a reduction in prey base for a broad range of avian and mammalian predators, some of which are species of greatest conservation need. Wildlife killing contests aimed at prairie dogs not only threaten these Tier 1 and Tier 2 prairie dog species, but also other species of greatest conservation need. Please eliminate wildlife killing contests. They are antithetical to responsible management and conservation of Colorado's native wildlife species. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Emmerich. Any comments or questions? Thank you. Taylor Jones with Wild Earth Guardians.
Hello, thank you very much for hearing our comments today. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Taylor Jones. I am the Endangered Species Advocate for Wild Earth Guardians, and I live in Denver, Colorado. I have a Master's in Conservation Biology and Sustainable Development from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I wanted to expand a little bit on the previous comments on the ecosystem services that prairie dogs provide. I've done a literature review on this subject, which I have copies of here, and I'll pass those around. And in summary, prairie dogs provide the following ecosystem services: increased groundwater recharge, water penetration into the soil, soil aeration via digging and tunneling, carbon sequestration via soil carbon storage, which has been recorded as higher in prairie dog towns than in mesquite scrub or in unoccupied grasslands. Increased nutrition content in plants due to clipping of vegetation that promotes new growth. They create a diverse mosaic of grassland habitats. They prevent desertification via controlling mesquite and woody plant growth. And as was mentioned before, they create a diverse mosaic of habitat for dependent and associated species, including the black-footed ferret, which is listed as endangered. They also create wildlife viewing opportunities for diverse species, including the prairie dogs themselves. And killing contests combined with other stressors on prairie dog colonies will inhibit their ability to provide these important ecosystem services. And not only that, I did want to mention prairie dog killing contests have produced some of the most egregious examples of animal cruelty. You can find these very easily on YouTube, shooters celebrating the results of their shot by producing red mist or triple axel flips. This sort of treatment of wildlife is antithetical to ethical hunting. Thank you.
Thank you, Taylor. Thank you for being here. And thank you for passing out the literature review. That's always super helpful. Any questions or comments? Okay. Delia Malone. Uh-oh. I was on those not too long ago. I did have a note. I don't have a blue slip, but I did have a note that Professor Diana Tombach might want to also present. Is Professor Tombach here? Okay, great. We'll go ahead and get on to Celia.
First of all, thank you so much, commissioners and directors, for taking the time and consideration. I'm Delia Malone. I'm an ecologist who has worked throughout Colorado conducting surveys for rare plants and animals in communities for the last 20 years. I'm also the wildlife team chair for the Colorado chapter of the Sierra Club, which has 111,000 members and supporters just in Colorado. I'll focus my comments on coyotes and coyote killing contests because coyote killing contests are so common. Killing coyotes does not increase game species. Because coyotes eat deer fawns, on the surface it sounds reasonable to kill coyotes to improve fawn recruitment. Evidence shows us otherwise. Numerous large, long-term studies in Wyoming, Utah, Montana, and Colorado have lethally removed coyotes from large areas to assess the benefits of coyote control and mule deer on mule deer populations. None have found any evidence that coyote removal resulted in increased deer population growth. No studies, including those conducted by CPW in Colorado, have demonstrated that coyote predation has caused deer herds to decline or have prevented deer herds from increasing. Further, killing coyotes does not reduce their population. Conversely, science documents that lethal removal stimulates coyote reproduction and immigration and actually increases coyote populations. Reducing predators to reduce predator-livestock conflict seems like a reasonable strategy. However, science shows us differently. Killing coyotes is ineffective and actually creates problems. In one USDA study, researchers found that as more predators were removed, more livestock were killed. In another 14-year-long USDA study, researchers found that trapping of coyotes did not reduce sheep losses. In fact, science found that as trappers worked more hours, more lambs were killed by predators. Why? Social predators like the coyote compensate for reductions in populations with increasing immigration, reproduction, and pup survival rates. So, what's the solution? One researcher suggested, guard coyotes. If a pair of coyotes is not killing livestock, their dominance over the territory typically excludes sheep-killing predators and helps to prevent livestock losses. Killing contests are indiscriminate. The nature of indiscriminate killing is to disrupt social structure and the stability that maintains that system. To finish, Carter Niemeyer, now retired but former employee of Wildlife Services, our federal wildlife killing agency, shared the following with me just yesterday. Quote, clearly, coyote killing contests are for human sport and nothing more. Misguided beliefs are that killing contests benefit and protect livestock and prey species, but the results of a killing contest is a response by surrounding coyote populations to disperse back into the hunted area after a short time. Coyote killing contests are about human egos and competition. Please, wildlife killing contests should be abolished. Thank you for considering.
Thank you, Ms. Malone. Any follow-up questions? Comments? Thank you. I do have two more blue slips.
I'm just going to hop off.
Hop off into the sunset. Be careful, please. Karen, I think it's Mahona. Is that correct? Okay, great.
Welcome back. Hi, I'm Karine Mahunam, and I live in Colorado Springs. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and to thank you for addressing the issue of wildlife killing contests. I've been blessed with the opportunity to have spent countless days in our wilderness areas, both here in Colorado, as well as backpacking in the Wind River Range, Beartooth Mountains, Boundary Waters Canoe Area, and Isle Royal, to name just a few. I've encountered a variety of wildlife close up, including bear, coyote, fox, raccoon, skunk, and rattlesnakes, and treasure each of those encounters, although I really could have done without the rattlesnake. Who knows how many more visited our campsites as we slept, and yet none ever made a move to harm us. In fact, instances of wild animals harming humans are extremely rare, despite many being much more powerful than us. While some are curious on occasion, most appear to fear us, and rightly so. Our destruction of our natural environment and the wildlife that inhabits it has been both ruthless and relentless. While I have never been a fan of hunting, I had gradually learned to accept regulated and ethical hunting for the purpose of obtaining food. We are, after all, omnivores, and meat is a natural part of our diet. I had also come to know several people whom I respected who did hunt ethically for food. However, my attitude towards hunters in general changed radically when I became aware of wildlife killing contests a few years ago. My default vision or picture of hunters is now that of those who participate in wildlife killing contests. And for them, to be honest, I have the utmost contempt. I hope and pray that you will soon bring an end to this senseless violence. All animals are sentient beings that only want to live and raise their families. They have an inherent right to do so. Most people, including ethical hunters, recognize that right. Indeed, it is one of the core principles of the North American wildlife model. The fourth tenet states that wildlife should only be killed for legitimate purposes. There is no purpose to indiscriminate killing of wildlife. Our native wildlife are all important to the functioning of a healthy ecosystem. They have evolved together and support each other in a complex system that we are only beginning to understand and are incapable of duplicating. The sixth tenet of the North American wildlife model is that science is the proper tool for the discharge of wildlife policy. Within the CPW strategy plan, you state in your management principles that the department will make science-based management decisions, that you will be a national leader in biological and natural resource sciences, that you will use science to inform management decisions. The best available science says that non-lethal coexistence plans are more effective than killing carnivores to deter livestock depredation. Indiscriminate killing of coyotes or other predators that are not causing any problems only opens up their territory to others or less experienced predators that could then cause a problem because they never had the chance to be trained by their parents to be effective hunters of their natural prey. It is past time for Colorado as well as the rest of the world to stop catering to the minority of hunters who engage in wildlife killing contests and indiscriminate killing of wildlife, and to stand instead with the ethical hunters who are the majority. And it is time for CPW to stand up for what's right and to be the leader that they claim they want to be. Let's end wildlife killing contests now. And I want to say one more thing and end with a quote from Leo Alpott. We abuse land, and that includes everything above and below the land as well, because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with the love and respect. From Aldo Leopold. Anyway, I just want to thank you for considering this, and I really, really hope and pray that you guys make a good decision regarding this.
Thank you, Ms. Hunan. And if you recall, this is not an action item today. We won't be making any action. This is information as well today, so thank you. Deborah Taylor, because we are so far behind in time, if you feel your comments have already been covered by other speakers, that would be great. If you have new comments that haven't been touched on, please, I'll welcome you. Okay, thank you.
Comments Yeah, we can. Yes, we can do one. Thank you. Quickly, and I've spoken before. Commissioners, thank you for allowing me to speak. Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Deborah Taylor. I live in Denver and also third of the time in Teller County. My great-grandfather was a rancher, a large rancher in western South Dakota. My sister is currently a rancher. My cousins are ranchers also, and I am an outdoor enthusiast. I'm a member and volunteer with Endangered Species Coalition and numerous other outdoor organizations. Regarding item 20, wildlife contest status, the world in just a few months lost over a billion wildlife. And if you think about that, the whole world has lost a billion wildlife, most of them in Australia, and we're talking about allowing people to continue randomly kill animals for fun. I hope Colorado will progress along with the other five other states which have banned predator and fur-bearing killing contests. Arizona, California, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and Vermont. Remember the passenger pigeons? We had so many of them. They're gone. We had wildlife killing contests of the passenger pigeons. They could go out and kill them in mass numbers. They are gone. Additional states are considering legislation to ban coyote-specific contests and other wildlife killing contests. I ask you to consider a full ban on the killing contests of both predator and non-predator wildlife. These predators' diets are heavy in rodents. Hantavirus is a problem in Colorado as well across the nation. Colorado currently had 104 cases in Colorado of hantavirus. 36% of hantavirus cases result in death. Foxes, coyotes, they all take out mice. Possums consume ticks. Water fur bearers eat insects. All of these are the mice, the insects are disease carrying. And to even think about shooting off these animals. Prairie dogs, they provide food for raptors. Basically, that's it. Thank you for listening, and I yield 40 seconds.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Do you want to pass around that other public comment? We can just share. We can. Thank you. Make you come all the way. Thank you. Okay, we have one more public comment, and then I do think we need to move on to the next agenda item. David Spoos.
I'd like to thank members of the commission for allowing me to speak. My name is Dave Sluss, and I live in Edgewater, Colorado. Wildlife killing contests violate the fundamental principles of ethical hunting. In these events, the concept of fair chase is frequently disregarded, and the animals killed are usually left to waste. These issues can lead Coloradans to view this enthusiasm for mass killing of animals as barbaric, cruel, and wasteful, which can negatively impact not only the image of sportsmen and women, but of the hunting industry in general. State agencies and officials have recognized the damage killing contests inflict on traditional hunting. Ray Powell, former member of the New Mexico Commission of State Lands, has said, "The nonspecific indiscriminate killing methods used in commercial and unrestricted coyote killing contests are not about hunting or sound land management. These contests are strictly about personal profit and animal cruelty. It is time to outlaw this activity, and in 2019, New Mexico did just that." Again, in 2019, Arizona Fishing Commission said, "To the extent these contests reflect overall hunting community, public outrage with these events has potential to threaten hunting as a legitimate wildlife management function." The commission also banned this in last October. Also in 2019, Massachusetts had banned these killing contests, and in doing so, they recognized that public controversy over this issue has the potential to threaten predator hunting and undermine public support for hunting in general. With these issues in mind, I'd like to ask that Colorado take its inspiration from these remarkable, forward-thinking professionals, and likewise defend its renowned reputation as a recreational destination by banning these cruel, unsporting, and wasteful contests. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Sluss. Any comments? Okay, I think staff is, Katie is looking for direction from commission on this. Do we have any commission discussion or direction? I think the direction they're looking for is, do we want to continue staff to look into this issue, or do we not? Is that correct, Katie?